Hi, I'm Ben Wallace.
Hi. And I'm Michael Wong.
And we are Goodness Over God. Well, today we have a special guest, Professor Robin Collins from Messiah College. He is perhaps the leading proponent of the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God today. He is a distinguished philosopher. He's written a large number, maybe 35 or so articles and chapters in various publications, major press publications in philosophy of religion, philosophy of science, and we are especially pleased to have him here with us today. Professor Collins, would you like to introduce yourself to the audience?
I'm Robin Collins, and I'm very glad to be on this program and talk about the fine-tuning argument and answer some potential critiques of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. We're happy to have you.
Well, we can begin, perhaps. Would you like to maybe give an overview of the argument? I know you have sort of a four-point argument that you like to use, right?
Right. I don't know if it's a four-point argument, but the idea is this. Recent, let's say last 30 years, have discovered that the universe is extraordinarily fine-tuned for the existence of life, in particular what I call embodied conscious agents that can interact with each other and can at least contemplate moral action, what they take to be moral action. So it's fine-tuned for that. And what does that mean? It means if the basic structure of the universe were slightly different in many, many different ways, such agents couldn't arise. So, for example, one widely discussed in the cosmological literature is the fine-tuning of what's known as the cosmological constant, or the dark energy density of the universe. That contributes to the expansion rate of the universe. If it were slightly larger, a typical estimate of 1 part in 10 to the 120th power, which is 1 followed by 120 zeros, if we're slightly larger just by that amount, the universe would expand so fast that galaxies and stars couldn't form. And without galaxies and stars, you can't get life to evolve. Slightly smaller in the negative direction, it's the universe would collapse too quickly before any life could evolve. So that's one example. There's many, many more examples. There's about 5 fundamental constants that are fine-tuned to a very high degree of accuracy for life to exist. And there's, I've counted, maybe 12 to 14 separate laws of nature that need to be set just right, along with what's called the initial conditions of the universe. And that's probably the most astounding case of fine-tuning. The initial conditions of the universe are the arrangement of mass and energy when the universe started, and that's been estimated to be fine-tuned 1 part in 10 raised to the 10 to the 123rd power. And translated in another language, the universe has a very low entropy state it starts off with, which is under a standard measure that's used in a branch of physics called statistical mechanics, turns out to be enormously improbable arrangement. So all those things, the universe is set just right. A natural explanation of that is that God desired to bring embodied conscious agents into being because there was some good to be realized, some value. So you would expect an all-good God. It wouldn't be surprising, at least, for an all-good God to create a universe with such beings in it and set it just right so those beings could evolve and arise. On the other side, under a naturalist, what I call a naturalistic single universe hypothesis, in which there is no God, the universe is just here and there's only one universe, it's enormously surprising, enormously improbable, where the probability here is epistemic probability, which is a measure of the degree of surprise or expectation of something being the case. So, in in the case of the cosmological constant, that surprise would be something on the order of 1 in 10 to the 120th power. So then I use a principle of confirmation theory called the likelihood principle. If one, if a certain body of data is much, much more surprising under one hypothesis than another, then it confirms the hypothesis it's under which it's least surprising. So an example of that would be fingerprints on a gun. Why do fingerprints on a gun typically confirm the guilt hypothesis over the innocence hypothesis? Or the matching of fingerprints, to be more precise. Well, under the innocence hypothesis, that the defendant's fingerprints match those on the gun would be very unlikely, especially if there's many, many points at which they match. Where under the guilt hypothesis, the defendant actually grabbed the gun and killed the person, it's not surprising at all. So because it's not surprising under the guilt hypothesis, but very surprising under the innocent hypothesis, it confirms the one over the other. So part of the core argument is that because of this principle of confirmation theory, the data of fine-tuning strongly confirm theism over the naturalistic single universe hypothesis. Then I have ways of dealing with what's called the multiverse hypothesis, in which there's many, many universes, which is an attempt to explain the fine-tuning, an attempt that many physicists have advocated, such as Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking thinks that fine-tuning is very real, but puts forward a multiverse hypothesis. One of the objections to that I've raised in an article with Universe or Multiverse, published with Cambridge University Press, it's a collection of articles on this issue, is that the multiverse generator, it's usually a physical process, they hypothesize it, generates these multiverse, would itself have to be well put together, fine-tuned, in other words, to generate even one life-permitting universe. And I look at one of the major, most widely advocated versions of the multiverse generator that generates all these universes and shows in all the ways it has to be set just right for life to exist. So that's a real quick rundown of the basic kind of argument I'm pushing forward.
Sure, and we'll obviously have a link to your website on the blog and on the website, so and on our website, so that those who are interested can look in your argument in more detail. But the first thing that comes to my mind, though, when I hear the fine-tuning argument, is how do you assess probability outside of a context? I mean, it would be one thing if there were some mechanism that physics postulated. We, in our best model of the world, there was some kind of mechanism that set those values. And, you know, kind of that there really were dice being rolled. But as I understand it, that's not the case. Sure, we can look at this potential range of possible values, but it's not as if we have any way of saying what, you know, there's no way of knowing what the distribution would be. There kind of isn't a distribution in that there's no mechanism to go and establish one value over another. So kind of in the absence of context, how can we talk about probability in any way?
Well, I think it's faulty, first of all, to think that you have to have like a mechanism to give you probability. There's a huge confusion about the issue of objective probability. Let me just give an example of this confusion, and then I'll go and give another example where probability is clearly epistemic. So I'm talking about epistemic probability, first of all. Now, I actually think all probability ends up reducing to epistemic probability, but let me just give you a very quick argument that it reduces to, and then I'll show you other examples, even if you don't buy the reduction argument, where epistemic probability is really important, and then how you can apply it over to the case of the fine-tuning. So let's suppose you do roll a die, all right, and has, you know, you roll this and you say it's one in a sixth chance. Now, what makes that probability? Let's even give another case where you construct a trillion-sided die, or 20-sided die. I give an example of a 20-sided die, so you can actually construct that. That's symmetrical. And no one's ever produced that before. Mm-hmm. And it's weighted equally on each side. you're going to know what the probability is for any given number. It's going to be 1 over 20. And there you're applying a principle of indifference. You're saying, well, each side, we give it an equal probability because they're symmetrical. We have no reason to prefer one side over another.
Well, you're applying a uniform distribution, and that much
right.
is... But I guess I don't see how we have to appeal to a principle of indifference to get that uniform distribution. It seems to me that, yeah, okay, we've never seen a trillion-sided die. Fair enough. But
mm-hmm.
We've seen six-sided die. We've seen 20-sided die. I mean, we've observed the behavior in the physical world of these symmetric bodies, right? And so it makes sense to inductively infer that, okay, yeah, you go up to you scale up to 3,000, you're going to get the same kind of symmetric behavior. That seems to me different than saying that, well, I don't know, so I'm just gonna cut it up, you know, in a uniform way, sort of out of ignorance. No, it's not that we're ignorant. We do know something about the world, and that's the basis for our assignment.
I think even if we didn't have the case of a 20-sided, six-sided die, we would think it'd be 1 in 20 because we would say we have an equal difference. And no matter how many, even how to die or any other kind of figure that you'd have, you know, a ball. You haven't really, in a ball, used two circles on it, and you roll it, you're still going to go, I think, 1 in 20, and I think it is epistemic. And let me go to that argument, why I think it's epistemic, because you can imagine you live in a deterministic universe. So really, in a deterministic universe, it's not as though you do have repeated trials. The side is going to come up is determined by the initial conditions, actually. So what you really have, it all really traces back to a probability distribution over the initial conditions of the universe. And since there's only one universe, there's no repeated trials. The only way of making sense of that distribution is an epistemic distribution, and that's actually goes back to the standard distribution that's used in statistical mechanics, where you do an equal probability distribution over a set of natural variables, which are usually called the canonical variables. So I think in that case, there is no other option but an epistemic probability. So we're doing it there at a very foundational level. But even apart from this case where you think you have experience, it's used, as I mentioned in that long paper I wrote for the Blackwell Companion. In science, we do that all the time in cases we have no experience with. For example, atomic theory, how was it confirmed? Well, what was the argument was, is there was all these different cases where they could calculate Avogadro's number, which is in the number of carbon atoms in one mole of carbon, okay, or one number of atoms in a mole, actually, which is 12 grams of carbon, if I remember right. So it's Avogadro's number, and you calculate it by many different ways, and you all get the same result. That they could make sense of that under atomic theory, why that would be the case, but it seemed enormously improbable and if atomic theory was false. Now, there's no experience with that sort of improbability. We're in a unique universe. It's a single case. Mm-hmm. And yet, we can speak about improbabilities. We did the same thing when the confirmation of the thesis of common ancestry, or at least the evolution, or the continental drift, I'm sorry, and same thing actually occurs with the thesis of common ancestry, continental drift. Let's say the similarity between the animal and plant life in, let's say, 2 million years ago on South American continent and Africa. If the continents were apart and they evolved separately, it would seem enormously improbable that you would get this very similar life forms on each of them. But it was not improbable if the continents were together. So once again, you're judging these probabilities way outside any experiential context. And another case I'd mentioned in the article was the case of the confirmation of quantum electrodynamics by its prediction to 9 decimal points of the geomagnetic moment of the electron. And once again, we're doing that improbability argument.
In the case of the continental drift or common descent, I mean, it seems that sure those are unique events, but we're applying you know, models of the way the world works, physical models of the way the world works, to go and arrive at those epistemic probabilities. I don't object to the idea of epistemic probabilities, but it's just that those probabilities are derived from, or at least I don't see how else they can be derived, from our background experience with the way the world works. That
we have very little background experience there, but you could argue we have a little bit in the case of similarity in animal and plant life. We have none in the case of the atomic theory case of those kinds of coincidences. We just don't have any background experience. Those are pretty unique. And so what you do is you put an equal probability distribution over the natural variable. Especially that's clear in the case of quantum electrodynamics. So I give an argument of how that's really what's going on there. And so you have a variable, and it's a what you consider a natural variable, maybe the simplest that occurs in a fundamental theory, and you put an equal probability distribution over it. And so you get an epistemic probability out of that.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, okay. So it would be, I guess I don't know about the about atomic theory enough to go and speak to it. I mean, it's like, so I apologize for that. I'm just not really prepared to address that directly. So I don't know if it's possible to go and speak about this in terms of evolution or continental drift. I guess I would just say broadly, before we can go and talk about how probable anything is. I mean, do you think we can talk about probability a priori then without any kind of reference to any experience, any of the patterns of even very, very generally of like kind of this is the way things generally go, that we see distribute, you know, like even the standard distribution is something that, you know, we observe, you know, in reality and in our experience, that's something we can imagine a universe where you know, even though it would be a very strange universe, where we wouldn't see a standard, or rather the standard distribution wouldn't come up very much, you know, as much as it does, you know, in our experience. There could be a universe where for some reason, you know, whenever you have a six-sided die and you roll it, well, most of the, you know, as fair as it may be, a six comes up most of the time, where, you know, well, you know, maybe 9 times out of 10, a six will come up. I mean,
right, or it could be in our universe.
Mm-hmm. What?
It could be in our universe, you know, you roll the die. Mm-hmm. And what allows you, you know, so you roll this die and you try it, let's say, 20 times, and every time it comes up seemingly random, mm-hmm. then how do you judge the probability into the future? It could be all kind, you know, it could be, from now on, it might come up 6, or it might come up 4, but we say one sure. is more probable than another. So even in our extrapolations into the future, we're using a kind of a priori probability, because we've never done the extrapolation before.
Well, we're using induction.
Yeah, I mean, we assume that the regularities of our experience will hold up, but do you think we need more than that, though?
Yeah, we need more, because that is, first of all, that's not a strict regularity in that case. It's because we don't think the regularity, let's suppose we observe, let's say, a coin, and it comes up, let's say, 4 times, and let's say 3 of them are heads and 1 of them is tails. We don't actually think that that regularity is going to continue. We're more likely to think, no, that's an anomaly, mm-hmm. and it's probably going to come up 1/2. So what we do is we extrapolate into the future on statistical cases with probabilities. And there's a lot of a priori assumptions go into that extrapolation. How do we extrapolate? We're not doing a direct extrapolation. We don't just suddenly think, oh, the coin, now I've seen it, it's 1 out of 4 times that comes up tails, or let's say heads. One of them was tails, and the 3 were heads. It's going to do that in the future. No, we think that gives some probability. It gives evidence that maybe it's biased. A little bit of evidence it's biased towards heads.
Sure. In that case, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. But then, if you do a Bayesian analysis, mm-hmm. you'd have various, you know. There'd be one hypothesis, it's a fair coin, and then a certain probability of it coming up that way under a fair coin hypothesis. And then a certain probability you give to it, it's biased. A certain probability is oppositely biased, and then one begins to get confirmed over the other. But there you have all these a priori probabilities you're starting to come up with.
Yeah,
using them.
Yeah, I certainly agree that our judgment about the coin isn't based on past flips of that coin or even other coins necessarily. But what it does seem to be based on, though, is our physical model of the world. We take when we go and we have this notion of density and center of gravity, and there are some kind of more abstract ideas that we have learned from experience about the way the world works, and we can apply that to brand new situations because we can break down that new situation. We can go and look at the coin and say, okay, here's this. We never flipped a coin before. Say, what kind of frequency should we expect? Well, given that there's nothing, for instance, there's nothing special about having a face, drawn on one side that's going to make it more likely that the face is going to land upright. We don't have models that address things like that. Given that the coin is uniform in density, and we know something about the way the way things fall, and how we still have these models that are themselves based upon our experience, the regularities of our experience. And so we're still using induction in the end, aren't we? Because we rely upon the models that we would have, no business relying upon in the future if we weren't using induction, if we weren't going and just supposing that, the way the world has worked in the future, in the past, which has led us to develop these models, well, the world will continue to work that way in the future as well. So we can continue to use these models, and that tells us that there's a 50-50 chance that the coin will come up the way it's going to come up.
Yeah, I don't actually think that's. First of all, the models aren't just based on direct extrapolation. Very few models in science are. We have models that we test against experience. So sure, models are tests, and they have to conform, to experience. They begin to get disconfirmed by experience. I would agree with that. We do have some kind of abstract model in our head, but we're not just directly getting that from experience. Because one thing every case is unique, and there could be radically different cases. We still apply this probabilistic reasoning to, like I mentioned, in the 20-sided coin or trillion-sided coin or the ball that's rolling. And I think if you even look at there's an abstract model, but we're not getting that directly from experience. Sure, we want to test it against experience. That I would agree with. But I think the abstract model then also builds in a probability measure itself. And so what we do is have an abstract model of where we should put the equal probability distributions, let's say, in the model, what variables we should use. And then we test that against experience to see if it works, which confirms and confirms or disconfirms our model. But I think that same thing, we do have a model in the case of a probabilistic model in the case of the fine-tuning equal probability distribution over the natural variables. Mm-hmm. And so I don't deny we have a model in our head, but I don't think those models are just directly gotten from experience. I think that's especially clear in those cases in science where we talk about improbabilities of things that are we've never had experience before, anything remotely like experience, like I said, the case of atomic theory, and or the case of confirmation of quantum electrodynamics by its precise prediction.
Well, I'm curious, though. I mean, if, sort of like Michael, I can't speak to the physics number that has no experiential background for the scientist. But at least in the case of some of the other examples you mentioned, common descent, the continental drift theory, if we could divorce ourselves from the experience, if we could sort of forget, everything we know about, animal migrations or whatever, do you think that we would still be able to make at least a weaker version of the same inferences about continental drift or common descent or that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think we could, because what we have is we're doing an equal probability distribution over what's called configuration space in physics, a space we think our normal space of x variables, y variables should be equal probability getting one configuration over another. And so I think that's lurking in the background in these kind of judgments we make.
I guess I'd be very nervous about doing. I mean, it seems like at least maybe I do that and I'm not aware, right? But if I became aware that I was doing that, I sort of would want to stop because I wouldn't feel like I had any reason to go and prefer that distribution over any other.
But what you want to ground it in is all induction, right? But what do you take induction as being?
Well, I suppose we have experiences and we find certain regularities in our experience and we generalize to a larger, we generalize typically into the future, right? Some kind of larger context so that we can predict and control our experiences.
Yeah, that isn't to say that there isn't a creative element.
Generalize, what does that mean?
Well, suppose we have an experience of type A, and we notice that, experience of type A, well, it's always followed by experience of type B, okay? And, we take notice of this, and we say, okay, well, I'm going to, if enough, instances of, B following A happen, and indeed B always follows A, then I'm going to infer inductively that any time I have an experience of type A, well, I better get ready for an experience of type B.
Which isn't to say, let me just add here, that it's not as if models aren't, I think both Ben and I recognize that, there's a creative process in developing models and that there are heuristics that we use, heuristics that we use unconsciously. But it's not as if there's just some direct, mechanical way to get from our experience to a model. But as you pointed out, once, however we generate a model, we're going to discard a model if it doesn't, in fact, if it isn't predictive, if it doesn't work. So
it doesn't account for experience, right?
I would say if it doesn't predict and control experience, then we ought to discard it. So sure, there's this creative element, but I can spin models all day long, right, and just use my imagination that have no bearing on reality at all. That's cheap. But the models that we rely upon, well, there are things that we've come up with, sure, we probably have evolved to come up with good models, I would think. So we come up with these models, they work, and then we apply them to new situations. And it still all depends upon induction. The virtue of our models, I should say, depends upon induction, even if their bare origin involves, just facts about us that have nothing to do with the truth or falsity of the model.
Let me just say what when you said extrapolation from experience, the way you generalized it, I would see a large number of problems with that because, first of all, it's such a vague rule that, as stated, it's almost useless. How many repetitions do you need to be confident? Do you need a billion repetitions? Is 100 enough? Unless you can answer that question, it doesn't give you anything. And to answer that question, then you're going to have to go into a deeper analysis than just saying induction. That's one of the problems. So it doesn't tell you anything unless you can quantify in some way how many instances are required to infer probably, if A is always associated with B, that will continue. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that I think induction relies on the assumption that the world is going to be relevantly similar into the future. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in California, if you're living out in California, the earthquake hasn't occurred today. Does that make it more probable it won't occur tomorrow? No, it makes it less probable because the longer an earthquake hasn't occurred, the more the pressure's built up underneath. You better hope that small earthquakes occur often. Okay, so now you have an underlying theory. Tomorrow is not going to be relevantly the same. Eventually, it's not going to be relevantly the same as today. The pressure is going to build up. Its rocks are going to eventually bust underneath San Francisco, and you're going to get a major earthquake. Mm-hmm. So very key to induction, even apart from this other problem, is the assumption that the world is relevantly similar. And you'd have to define what relevantly means. And how do you even get to that? I mean, that's a huge, huge assumption that's underlying this, relevantly similar in such a way that the pattern's going to continue. How do you judge the probability of that? You're not using induction anymore, because that's what's underlying induction. So it's an a priori judgment you're making. The third problem is probabilistic induction. You don't do a straight rule on probabilistic induction. So like I mentioned, you know, the coin comes up, you know, 3 out of 4 times on heads. You don't say, well, it's going to continue doing that. So what I would claim, if you dig down deeply under induction, even when you can apply induction, you get all kinds of a priori assumptions about probabilities, like the probability being relevantly the same.
The nice thing about induction is that we can that it's recursive in a sense, and that I can go and develop a model that maybe was inspired by observation of regularities, and then I can go and test my model and say, like, say I suppose, well, look, there, you know, that the probability of there being an earthquake is lower. There hasn't been an earthquake for, you know, ever since I've been alive. So, gee, the odds are really slim. There'll be an earthquake tomorrow, and then the earthquake occurs. Well, I might go and conclude that my model was too simple, that I needed to take into account, geology and, additional information. I would say that in the end, what saves us from just making, generalizing too quickly, from having too simple of a model, is induction, because we try our models and they work or they don't work.
Well, that's testing. That's not quite induction. That's because induction is generalizing from experience. That's testing the model.
But once I've tested it, then I have to look back and say, gee, this model's working well, or this model isn't. And then I have to ask myself, do I use this model in the future or don't I? So it's still induction. I mean, sure, there's testing, but again, what good are my tests if I don't suppose that testing is relevant for the future, right?
Well, so you're taking it as relevant as confirmatory of the model. That's what you do. So your model predicts a certain thing. And there you're drawing an expectation out of your model. If your model is correct, it would, you know, predict this to occur. If it's not correct, it's very unlikely, let's say, you would expect this to occur. And then you use a form of confirmation theory to confirm the model over its contenders.
Okay,
so
but I'm making
and there
predictions.
You're building in now probabilities that go a priori, like the probability that, you know, there's always contenders. You can generate any number of models you want that will explain the data, which is really clear in the case of curve fitting. You know, when you fit data points to curves, any number of models you can get would exactly predict those data points, and it's a mathematical theorem. Mm-hmm. That's the case. In fact, an infinite number of them. So then you have to do an a priori weighting over which models you think, it's usually the simplest, that you think are the most likely to be true. So an a priori weighting comes into play right there that's not based on induction.
Well, those weights, though, aren't they more or less expressions of the regularity? I mean, yeah, there are, of course, an infinite number of curves that you could fit on any data set, but only one curve expresses a regularity in the sense that we typically understand the term, or at least...
Well, what you're doing is you're extrapolating into the future whenever you say, you want to say, well, that's based on a regularity, that's what we do. But that's also then, you can always extrapolate from the past. The past is like your data points, right? So your past is, let's say, you're measuring force against acceleration, and you put data on your graph. So you do a simple graph, and there's quite a few data points you get. You can always get, like I said, an infinite number of curves that will exactly go through the data points. So usually what we do is we, you know, have error bars, and we put the simplest, let's say, a straight line in that case, through those data points. And the straight line won't hit all the data points because of our assumption that we have experimental error. That's what we usually do, but that's an assumption about the world is more likely to be simple or something like that than complex. The other curves actually all match the data points, in fact, even better, and there's an infinite number of them. So that's point number one. Now, you induce what you're doing. Now, let's say you guess what the future, you know, a measurement you haven't made. So you've made a measurement, you know, the relation of force to acceleration, all the way up to an acceleration of, you know, 20 meters per second squared. Okay, you've done it up to that point. And you want to know what's going to happen at 30 meters per second squared. Well, what of those curves do you use? You have an infinite number of curves going through there, and they'll give radically different results at 30 meters per second squared. But what you do is use the simplest one because you think the simplest is the most likely to be true. But so every instance of induction is assuming already giving you an a priori weight, let's say based on the simplicity of the model, to your extrapolation, because there's an infinite number of ways of extrapolating. So even if you appeal to induction, you still need an a priori weight somewhere in the case.
I agree to an extent, yeah. I mean, of course, we need... We're working under the umbrella of certain assumptions about what works best. But if we want that a priori weight to be, satisfying to us, well, we'll want to have some experience of that working in the past. I mean, I guess... Maybe it's. I don't want to make it sound too subjective, because we all share mostly the same values in this respect, I think. But it seems like, you know, if we didn't have some precedent for our strategies working, then we wouldn't have any, you know, reason to prefer one strategy over another. So if we see that simple curves fit, simple curves are, well, they're easy to work with, they're pragmatic, you know, least squares curves are fairly easy to work with, and so those make good candidates, you know, just out of pragmatic concerns. And then we go and we observe that, this gets us good results. It gets us from experience to experience. It seems to me that that's where we find the value in using those weights that you're talking about. If we didn't observe those things, if we didn't have that experience, I don't know what value we could find in them.
I want to add really quickly, I don't think it's so much that we assume that the world is simple, but that we recognize that we are limited. And we're going to have to use simple models. I mean, to the extent to which a model is overly complicated, it's going to be harder for us to use. We're going to want, you know, models that are simple so that we can understand them and apply them easily. That even that desire for simplicity can be justified, first of all, certainly in terms of just kind of the way we are, just psychologically, but also pragmatically.
That might be your motivation for it, but... Mm-hmm. That would be give us no reason if we just thought that it, unless we thought the universe was kindly geared for our structured for our discoverability, that would be workable for us. It would give us no reason to think we could extrapolate in the future, because if it was just pragmatic preference for simplicity, there's no reason to think the world is going to be structured in that way, continue to be structured in that way, because it's just that what we have to do. Maybe the world is in the future that it all deviates from the simplest curve, even though we've had hundreds and thousands of data points that it deviates. But we don't think that. We're much more confident in our predictions than that. So if we're just a pragmatic justification, we shouldn't have any confidence in our predictions.
Sure, you're evoking the problem of induction, and yeah.
Right, I think the problem of induction gets you to the problem of how we get the probabilities. I mean, you can't simply say, you know, we do it by induction, because if you start looking carefully at induction, you're going to see prior probabilities all over the place.
I thought, so you want to apply the restricted principle of indifference. Principle of indifference, of course, is fairly common, and you've come up with your own little spin on it called the restricted principle of indifference.
Wow.
Which is quite clever. I like it. I strongly disagree with it, though, I should say. But it is quite clever. But in order to build a case for that, I mean, you build a case from induction. You say, and pragmatism, you say that we need it, and look, it's been working for us. So it's almost like even you want to go ground this principle in induction.
Well, what I want to say is that's what, I mean, there is a sort of induction going on when you do epistemology. You look at what we assume in our normal practice when we do science. So we take, for example, it's often typically taken as our science is the kind of paradigm of rationality, like mathematics is. So if we're making certain assumptions in those domains, epistemic assumption we must make to even do that kind of inquiry, then we have good reason to believe those are kind of ground level epistemic principles or assumptions. And if somebody says, well, you're using this assumption and I don't agree with it, let's say, you know, I deny this assumption, so when I'm doing the fine-tuning argument, then I'll say, well, are you going to undercut all of science? You could be a real skeptic and say, well, I don't even confident in science anymore. Well, then we're on a different playing field. But I'm assuming you're accepting the validity of normal epistemic principles like we use in science, and there my extrapolation is saying, well, let's look at what those principles are. So I say we do use these principles. Let's say I mentioned simplicity or the principle of indifference. We're using them all over the place. Now, I can't give a proof from basic axioms for those. I just point out we're using them, and so they seem pretty close to rock bottom for us as we work in the world.
I certainly agree that we use them. I think Hume was right, though. I think that says something about our psychology. It doesn't tell us that we have some kind of deeper justification, except insofar as we can say this. It's not as if I have some reason not to use induction. You know, I mean, it's not as if there's some kind of rival theory that has some, you know, that has some better claim on my loyalty than induction. It's, you know, natural to use induction. I want to use induction. It has some interesting features that I think that other strategies or meta strategies don't have. You know, so I end up using it. But it doesn't mean we really have a justification for it. It's just something that, yeah, we're going to do it. I mean, it seems like that's the bottom line. It's really about our values.
We don't just do it for pragmatic reasons. We are actually confident. We have confidence in our extrapolations into the future based on induction, like, you know, the sun's going to rise tomorrow. We build airplanes. Or, you know, there is this use of induction. We're always going beyond, in all of our technology, we're always going beyond what we actually have demonstrated in experience. The experience is always, in the most simple case, it's always of the past. And so we're always going into the future, and we're pretty confident. So what it shows is that we actually have confidence in these prior probability distributions that are underlying our practice of induction, like, you know, that the simpler curve is more likely to be true. No one would say it would be 100% likely, but we say it's more likely to be the correct one. And so my point is that our common practice assumes prior probability distributions, and then, you know, my whole case of the natural variable, I say that's actually what's going on in certain areas of science, is the natural variable gets the prior probability distribution, and that's why we're doing it. And you know, in the case of the fine-tuning, that's why the multiverse is so popular for scientists, because they're implicitly aware that the fine-tuning presents a real challenge if it doesn't have a kind of other explanation. It seems to them really improbable.
Well,
because it conforms to what else they would call improbable on a priori grounds.
Well, it's definitely scrapes against certain folks' intuitions. There's no doubt about that. When we hear, you know, there's only going to be a very small region for a certain parameter in a physics model where the physics model describes a universe that permits life. And certainly some people are going to react to that subjectively in sort of amazement and surprise, right? I guess I would be concerned about justification, though. We are surprised subjectively by all kinds of things. We have certain subjective tendencies, but hopefully we want to go ground those. And this is what you're trying to do. You're on your website. you say, well, you know, this sort of analogy of the dartboard that you give, which illustrates the subjective reaction to this. And you say, well, this is enough for a lot of people. But some people, they want a more rigorous approach. And so you go and you develop this indeed very rigorous approach to the you know, applying the principle of indifference. If you're just going to go with intuition, that's one thing. But I don't see how...
We ultimately do bottom out on intuitions. It just, you want your intuitions to be maximally reflective. In other words, you keep thinking and reflecting and interacting until you get to baseline intuitions. You know, even areas like, you know, why do we believe modus tollens? You know, if P, then Q, not Q, therefore not P, is a valid form of argument. We haven't tested all the cases. In fact, in any given argument, it's really hard to thoroughly test its validity. You know, if the premises are true, you're guaranteed the conclusion is true. There's, you know, it's impossible for the premise to be true and the conclusion false. But it's intuition. It seems obvious to us. So all the logical connections, we're always going back down to our baseline intuitions that we get agreement on among human beings.
I would say that in the case of logic, it's like, I don't know what you mean if you deny modus ponens. We aren't speaking the same language there. There's a point where, you know, language breaks down sometimes, and I don't understand what you're trying to tell me. And that's you know, I think when it comes to logic and formal systems, that's the kind of certainty that I have, where I don't understand the contrary. But in the case of...
You want to make it completely analytic truths and not synthetic?
I guess I am talking about it. Yeah, I like the analytic and synthetic distinction, actually.
But I think that's really hard. That was really hard going, you know, the Quine's criticisms and other people's criticisms.
Well, even Quine granted that if you can stipulate... you know, it's not as if he was trying to go and say that you couldn't go and stipulate that this is what I mean, these are the rules we're going to follow in our formal system, and if you break, you know, if you break these rules, well, you aren't following this formal system. And I think that's what we're doing in the case of something like logic. So I mean, I think, you know, in the two dogmas, you know, he kind of allows for, you know, a kind of stipulative definitions. And that's really all that's what I think is going on in the case of logic, you know. So in that sense, the analytic-synthetic dichotomy is preserved even for Quine. It's just when you try to...
If you don't like logic, you could do other cases. I mean, and certainly
formal
in the case of induction, you're doing it.
Oh, in the case of induction, induction is... okay, yeah, you mean in terms of
Intuition. You're going down to baseline intuition, so I think that's what you've got to do, is you're going... And people might differ on those baseline intuitions, but I think the demands of rationality is that you probe, you get down to those baseline intuitions, and once you have them, you can't really go further.
Well, with induction, I have certainly a psychological confidence in induction. I really do. It's a fact about me that I just expect the future to resemble the past. However, I can be reflective, and I can recognize, I can kind of chuckle at myself and say, yeah, that's the kind of guy I am, but I'm not going to pretend I have a justification for it. It really is just a fact about me and my psychology. So, you know, I shouldn't go and pretend that I have a real justification just because I have these deep feelings, you know? I mean, and hopefully that's what, that's what being rigorous and careful, and that's what philosophy is all about.
Okay, so you say you don't have a real justification. I think you must have some idea what a justification would look like. Mm-hmm. So what would a justification look like for you? When could you have a real justification?
The justifications either occur within the context of formal systems, or they assume induction. You know, I have justifications, you know, kind of assuming induction and assuming other things too, but I need assumptions before I can even have justifications. So no,
I'm wondering, are you going a classical foundationalist route where you say, you know, I have to have these proofs that are self-evident or incorrigible, meaning, you know, the latter meaning if I cannot doubt, I'm like, you know, supposedly Descartes thought, I couldn't doubt I existed. Is that what you're meaning by justification, so that their baseline, where you start from, they're either impossible to doubt or they're self-evident, meaning you cannot understand what the claim is making without also understanding it being true?
Yeah, I'm going to say that I don't want to talk about it being incorrigible, but I want to say that there are some assertions that people can make, and the natural way for me to interpret them is such that I don't understand what would be meant by somebody who were to utter the negation of them. But which isn't to say that I think that you could, like the car, that you can go and climb all the way up and we can get the whole world that way. But what I want to do is I want to say, look, there, at some point we have to go and make a jump. We can't get much beyond this immediate experience. And things that are, you know, very immediate analytic truths, without going and appealing to something beyond that which I can't understand.
Right. So in science, are doing that all the time because you can't derive science from those foundational truths.
Sure. But this is the leap that I'm going to make. I'm going to recognize that it comes down to my values, that I'm going to go, I want to be an actor in the world, and to be an actor in the world in a certain robust sense, I have to go and assume induction. So I proceed as if induction were true, and then I can, through induction, I think I can build models of the world that enable me to predict and control experience. But I never forget, hopefully, that it's all in the end, it's grounded upon my values. The fact that I want to go and be engaged in the world in this way, so I'm going to go and make an assumption for practical purposes, never telling myself that I have some kind of deeper justification than that. Then, justifications occur within the context of those assumptions. That's where I'm coming from. It's kind of like classical foundationalism, but I think it's pretty humble, compared to if you want to take Descartes as a paradigm case of...
I don't see why then you couldn't just apply that to the fine... don't pretend I have the classical foundationalist justification of, this evidence for the existence of God. All I pretend is I have what you have, some of our shared deep epistemic principles that, based on those, you get and our epistemic intuitions that are shareable and that we can name what they are and how they're used. You get that it provides evidence for the existence of God. I mean, I don't claim to have anywhere near a classical foundationalist proof, because I think the non-classical foundationalist, what I've done, is the best you can do, given our circumstance we're in. Now, I don't think we always make those assumptions just for practical reasons. I mean, we believe all kinds of things that don't have, scientific theories that don't have any practical impact on me, common ancestry, atomic, beliefs about the universe began 13 billion years ago. I think there's good evidence for them, and I'm not believing those just on pragmatic grounds. It's not just to get around in the world. So I'm using these principles more than pragmatically. I'm using them, and if you want to go your route, then you should say, I'm not going to be a skeptic about all these other scientific theories that go beyond experience. I'm just going to stay with what I need to get around in the world. But not even you, I don't think, do that.
I understand. I meant, when I talk about getting around the world, I mean that in the broadest sense. I mean, I could have many different values. And I mean, look, things like common descent follow from models that do, in fact, enable us to get around the world. We can extrapolate from the models that tell us, what's going to happen in the future now, or that we suppose will tell us what's going to happen in the future now. And we can go and look at the way things happened in the past through those current models. Indeed, I don't think there's any other way to go and evaluate evidence as to what happened in the past, except through models that we can confirm today, ultimately.
Exactly what I'm doing in the fine-tuning argument. I'm looking at what we use in science, and if you want to say science helps us get around the world with its technology, the kind of epistemic assumptions we make, and then I'm extrapolating those to areas that, are not just helping us get around in the world, whether there's evidence for God's existence. So I'm just doing the same thing.
I can see. All right. So If we were to conclude, I don't think this is true, but if we went and we said, okay, I guess it's not all just about induction. We have to drag in a whole bunch of other assumptions, one of them being, you know, sort of, I don't know, some kind of set of rules or maybe just a single rule for assigning a priori probabilities when we assess evidence. It could be that, you know, that really is necessary to get around. Again, I don't think so. But even if that was the case, though, certainly we might come to value such a rule or such rules. But I guess I see other problems with the principle of indifference. I was rereading your chapter from the Blackwell Companion to Natural mm-hmm. Theology. Oh, by the way, for the listeners, he did contribute a chapter on the fine-tuning argument to the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology, and you can buy that on Amazon.com. It's a great read. So you want us to go and sort of imagine, you have a conceptual device that you use you want us to imagine maybe like a disembodied alien.
Mm-hmm.
The first few fractions of a second after the Big Bang, the alien, he sees that there's a universe, he gets some idea of the way that the universe is going to, you know, fall together. He has sort mm-hmm. of the structure of, you know, the physics models that he's going to end up using, but he hasn't filled in the parameters yet. There are these wide open parameters that need to be filled in.
Right.
And so from this epistemic position, he goes and he asks himself, all right, well, what range of parameters what range do the parameters need to fall into in order to be, in order to lead to a life-permitting universe? And he observes, mm-hmm. oh, there's a very relatively small, you know, range of values that are life-permitting compared to, you know, the values that I know about, the epistemically illuminated mm-hmm. range. And he says,
right.
And he says, okay, well, we have to apply the principle of indifference now. We have to say that, well, because this range has such a relatively small measure, well, that means that the probability, the epistemic probability, is going to be very, very small indeed.
Yeah, that's the best estimate we can give of the epistemic probability.
Right, right.
Right.
I guess here's a question that I was toying with, though. I mean, suppose that we went back even further, not to the first few fractions of a second after mm-hmm. you know the universe had mm-hmm. formed, but just at that moment when the alien sees, oh, here's a universe, and he doesn't have the structure of the model. You know, he doesn't have any model where he has parameter values to fill in. All he knows is there's a universe, and he's still interested in the question, is it going to support life or not?
Mm-hmm.
Then it seems like if we go and apply the same principle, then the natural variable here is no longer the parameter set. Now it's just that question of, you know, is it going to permit life or not?
Right.
In that situation, if he goes and applies the principle of indifference, then he ends up with a 50-50 shot.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's probably what we before may have had with the before the fine-tuning evidence. So it wasn't very impressive anymore. It wasn't thought to be that improbable. A lot of people thought, well, it wasn't that improbable for there to be a life-permitting universe. So no big deal. No need to infer to anything else. That's right. So you always do your probabilities with respect to the best models which you can do the calculations or you have access to. But that's just the way the world, you know, that's our human limitation. We always do that. So his best model is not very good.
Right. But so, when he does get to the point, so, you know, fast forward those few fractions of a second, though,
mm-hmm.
now all the information starts to come in, and he realizes, oh, you know, the universe is going to have this particular kind of structure. Well,
right.
You know, if we assume that the principle of indifference is valid, and it really has gotten us to a 50-50 chance at this point, now we have to evaluate the new information. The
right.
new information is you know, essentially it's so far so good, you know, out of all the crazy possibilities that the universe could have had, out of all the things that could have happened in those few fractions of a second, you know, we're still on track for something that's consistent with the development of life. Seems like the way that you want to treat evidence with the likelihood principle, that would be confirmatory evidence. That would confirm the hypothesis that indeed, you know, it will be life supporting.
I don't quite follow your argument, because at the beginning we have a 50-50. You know, the unembodied alien says 50-50. Then he learns his physics, and then realizes, no, it's a really small parameter space. So after learning that new information, updates the probability, which the alien should do. So
the way I read your argument, though, you only want to go apply the principle of indifference if we don't already have a reason to prefer, you know, one parameter set over another, right?
That's right, within our fundamental model.
Within the model.
Yeah. The best models we have.
Well, so he can't go and create a model of, you know... See, here's what I don't understand. If he can't go and create a model of, you know, what the universe is likely to do using the restricted principle of indifference at that first moment when it's 50-50... Why can he go and create a model with the restricted principle of indifference a few fractions of a second later?
It's what he expects the universe to do. His expectations, he can create a model with a 50-50. It's just that it's not a very good model. That's the best he can do. And then later, he creates another model. It's like going from a case where, you know, you have a die that you think is not weighted into learning it's weighted, then you update your model under the new information. And you're always dealing with epistemic probabilities, which just is your best estimate. You're something like that in a condition where you don't know everything. If you knew everything, then there's no probabilities left on condition on all the information. You just know what's going to happen. So, you know, when you toss a coin, your probability is conditioned on a certain amount of ignorance of what the exact configuration of air molecules is and how, you know, the way you toss the coin, etc. You knew all that, then there wouldn't be any probability left. So it's always conditioned on lack of knowledge. That's how epistemic probabilities work.
I guess I don't see how, if that's the case, then I guess I don't see how the restricted principle of indifference is supposed to be applicable.
Well, it's applicable to epistemic probabilities because it's like a case of a coin or a case of a die.
But it doesn't build. The way you're describing it is it's as if it doesn't build. It's like, yeah, we have the 50-50 probability, but, you know, as soon as we move into a different epistemic situation, well, we just have to forget about all of that. Unless...
Well, we do move into a better. I mean, you could have a worry is that if you had this situation going on, there was a lack of convergence. You know, you take a physical theory, and then you go down, you dig down for a while, and you get a physical theory, and things are really fine-tuned. Then you go to a deeper physical theory, level 2, and they're not fine-tuned anymore. Then level 3, they're back to being fine-tuned. Level 4, they're not fine-tuned anymore. Then you're going to lose all confidence that, you know, the baseline theory you could have, whether it's going to be fine-tuned or not. And so you want a sort of convergence. You want that if you're estimating if we got a deeper theory, we would it would be converging in the sense of it's generally going to be increasing, or the fine-tuning is not going to drastically decrease. Otherwise, we will lose confidence. But that's the same in science. I mean, if you have theories keep getting overturned, I mean, this was like, you know, Kuhn's criticism and others, you know, when you have revolutions that keep overturning the ontology of theories, then you begin to lose confidence. That happens all over the place.
Well,
so that would be a way if you could try to attack it that way and try to say, well, you know, we're explaining these fine tunings away and we're getting rid of them when we get to a deeper theory. I don't think that's happening. But you could try that. I should say one other thing I didn't point out about the one. There's one case we do have a probability measure for, and that's the case of the low entropy of the universe. So there we have, in entropy in general, we have a standard measure in statistical mechanics. Now, when you're dealing in the low entropy at the beginning of the universe, there's a little tricky stuff because of the measure over the curvature of space is a little tricky. But by and large, we have a standard measure of probability that we use in statistical mechanics, and that's an equal probability distribution over phase space. And there, when we do that, we get a very low probability. So there, we're not even having to make these other assumptions in that one special case.
Well, I still don't... I guess I still don't see how it all works out, but I'll go back and I'll reread and see if I can iron out the difficulty on my own. But Michael, I think, wanted to get back into induction and models again. So, Michael, what did you want to say?
Yeah, well, I wanted to. I mean, you said earlier, Dr. Collins, that like, well, that's what you're doing. You're taking the models that we use and you're applying them and to fine tuning. But I guess I have two problems with that. I mean, first of all, again, it seems like the usefulness of our models, wherever they come from. I mean, they're useful within the context of kind of understanding our universe, things within our universe. And so I'm concerned about going beyond our universe, going to the transcendent, given that they are, viewing them, as I do, as just tools for predicting and controlling our experience and kind of being limited to and kind of being defined by those very laws of physics. I mean, they make sense kind of given the way the universe works. So to talk about the universe working differently, it seems to be kind of misplaced. But more than that, I mean, the models that we have of consciousness, especially, I mean, consciousness in our experience is a feature, given the best models we have. And strictly speaking, Ben and I are idealists, but, we generally, talk like materialists because, those are the models that we can use, effectively. But consciousness seems to be a feature of biological systems. Consciousnesses don't have the power to, kind of wish for things and have those wishes come true. Consciousness, deals with the, conscious systems manipulate, the things in their environment. They have to learn from their environment. Why go and take, given the downside, given our complete model of consciousness such as we have it, why go and project consciousness, why project mind to this transcendent context rather than kind of any other arbitrary thing? I mean, it doesn't seem like that's a good, it seems like you're kind of picking and choosing, You're going to say, here's something here. Sometimes minds design things. So let's forget about everything else that we know about minds from our experience. We'll say that consciousness is the that's what we should put at the origin of everything. Did you see my concern?
Yeah, no, I do see your concern. I mean, one of the legitimate concerns is that all the minds we know of always use natural laws to bring about events in the world, and we're hypothesizing a mind of sorts that is radically different, that does not, whose intentions are realized without the intervention of any law of nature. And that goes back to the question of the prior plausibility of theism. Largely in my work, I did not address that question.
Mm-hmm.
My question is whether the fine tuning counts as evidence for theism. If you already think it has a non-zero probability or it has some viability, then does this give you significant evidence for it? And my answer was yes. and using the confirmation theory. That was part of the whole point of why I arranged things that I did. Unlike Richard Swinburne, who tries to give the prior probability based on this argument from simplicity of God, which I don't really buy the argument, so I don't do things that way. That's point number one.
Mm-hmm.
Point number two is that and this is on my infidels.org piece where I debated with Paul Draper. Are you familiar with that? Readers might be interested in going to infidels.org. It was the first online book debating theism and naturalism, and they brought some leading philosophers into
the I'm familiar with the website. Well, what's the book called on
it's
infidels?
It's called The Great Debate, and it's edited by Paul Draper.
Okay.
Philosophers Debate the Evidence.
We can certainly include that in the links to this episode.
Yeah, that would be a useful link because it's the only one I know of that around where you get, and this goes cosmology, covers mind, covers evolution, problem of evil. So, and it's on people on both sides. So it would be mm-hmm. useful for your readers to know about that one.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first part of the question. The second part is, there is a deep question about consciousness, and we don't have any good materialist account of consciousness. So, to me, it makes at least just as much sense to think that consciousness is primordial. Everything ultimately comes back to consciousness and person. That personhood is fundamental to reality, as it does non-personhood. And, for a variety of reasons, you can give arguments from consciousness, you can give cosmological arguments, ontological, religious experience, et cetera, et cetera. So if we think the case for on all those other grounds balances out, that consciousness being primordial.
Mm-hmm. Don't we have a pretty good account, though, of the potency of systems that are conscious? I assume you agree that, we can go and kind of understand behavior in terms of, maybe you're a skeptic about this, but do you think that in principle, if we understood neurology, perfectly well, and physiology, I should say broadly, perfectly well, that we could predict behavior?
I'm an entity or substance dualist. I defend that. There's a book.
Okay.
Called The Soul Hypothesis that's out, and an article in there, one of them, I have two of them in there, The Soul Hypothesis, edited by Stuart Getz and Mark Baker, and it was a bunch of mostly philosophers, one cognitive scientist mm-hmm. from Rutgers was involved too, who argued for the case for a form of substance dualism, and my chapter's entitled The Scientific Case for the Soul.
Okay. Even assuming a substance dualism for the sake of argument, would you agree that we have, outside of neurology, we don't have any, we don't have any examples of how consciousness interfaces with the world. In our cases, perhaps there's a disembodied soul, but if it manipulates the world, it's through it's through neurologies, right? It's through physiology in the end. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. But I wanted to say, because there's a certain premise you're making in the whole argument. Mm-hmm. I think you're making is that extrapolating from what we experience here in the world is relevant to God. That'd be relevant if God was another being in the world. But God's an ultimate explanation, and we don't want to expect an ultimate explanation to be radically different from anything we find in the world. Because otherwise, if God was like something else we find in the world, then God would be just as much in need of explanation as anything else.
So, go ahead.
The theistic hypothesis is God is somehow radically, it's the ultimate explanation, and the ultimate explanation is not going to be the same as anything else in the world.
Okay, but aren't you extrapolating from what we know about consciousness, like that consciousness is involved in creativity, for instance, and designing things. Aren't you extrapolating from our knowledge of the world to that transcendent realm? I mean, I always like to say let's talk about the transcendent. You know, let's talk about that which is, you know, really outside of the reaches of science. Well, I can go and say that there's a transcendent, you know, landscape. It's mostly green grass. There are rocks there occasionally. There are trees. There are birds chirping in the trees, birds of, you know, average intelligence. And there's a red wagon rolling along this transcendent landscape. And every time the red wagon strikes a rock, well, a new, say, you know, universe emerges that is consistent with life. And that's where our universe came from. Now, you can go and say, like, oh, gee, this is really, wagons aren't like that, you know what I mean? They don't have that power and stuff. It's like, well, look, this is transcendent, you know what I mean? I'm not, you know, saying this wagon or this landscape is just like our wagons and our landscape, you know, but there are some features there. It's red. The birds look at it. It's red. You know, it's rolling along in its transcendent way. I mean, you know, it seems to me that theists often, it's like there's a double standard. It's like, yeah, I can pick whatever I want out of our experience and apply it to a transcendent realm. But if you go and you try to go and apply other elements, then all of a sudden, hey, this is a transcendent realm. You know, the only thing that gets through to the transcendent realm are things that are helpful to theism. I mean, that's what I perceive. Can you tell me where I'm wrong there?
So only things that are helpful to theism, I'm trying to grasp what you're saying. I mean, because I have all kinds of problems with the red wagon. It wouldn't do any, I mean, any of those kind of hypotheses would just transfer whatever fine-tuning problems you have up to another level. I mean, theists are going to have to, my argument is not an argument for a generic designer. It would fail as a generic designer argument. I'm not basing it on that we see minds designing things. It's very much like the belief in the transcendent designer is somewhat like our belief in moral truths, or at least many people's belief that are objective morality. It's not an extrapolation from experience, or the belief in, you know, mathematical Platonism is not its a priori considerations. So
you're appealing
to God is something. It's not, you know, in the theistic traditions. Not, I'm not talking about the popular theism, because popular theism, God is a being out there that, you know, is, and even, you know, you find this is the image given in a lot of the Bible, is God out there who's external and then causing things to happen. But rather, I mean, within the developed theistic traditions, God is not like that at all, and that's long before the fine tuning. That's just on prior considerations. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing I would say. God is like God is being considered an ultimate explanation. So you have to have various criteria of an ultimate explanation if it's going to work. It's not picking and choosing. You're going to have to say it's got to be, let's say, if you're thinking cosmologically, it has to be a necessary being.
So,
because if it isn't, they'll need explanation. Why does it exist? The perfect goodness is essential to the teleological argument as I develop it.
You see, it has to be a necessary to being. I mean, does that mean that, I mean, in some sense, some ontological argument has to go through then, I mean, for your God to exist at all, right?
Well, it doesn't have to go through. It doesn't have to be a good argument in the sense it's convincing to anybody, but... Mm-hmm.
It has to be. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a good argument in the sense that we could know that God's a necessary being, or deduce that God, you know, must be. There is a necessary being like God that exists. That's what you'd think a good ontological argument would show, but. It's part of being God, I think, to be necessarily existent. So what you're doing when you're developing in this line of thought, the conception of God, is what would be required for a being to be the explanation of everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not an extrapolation from what we see in the world. If it's going to explain, why this world versus another, and why the world is structured a certain way. It gives us a kind of what Richard Swinburne stresses here is a kind. There's a kind of explanation. It's invoking not an impersonal explanation as we have in science of initial conditions and laws of nature. That's what he calls an inanimate explanation. But there's another kind of explanation, a personal explanation, in terms of reasons. And if it's going to be an impersonal explanation, there doesn't seem any candidate that would not just kick a problem back. You know, then you'd have, if you have meta laws to do it, then the meta laws seem like they need to be explained. So then you go to a personal explanation. A personal explanation, then that's your other alternative if you're going to have an ultimate explanation. I think there is actually a third alternative, but axiarchism, but a principle. I talk about that in another piece, but it's actually at the end of this, the Blackwell piece. But personal explanation is your second category. And so if you go with a personal explanation, then it's going to have to be a person that is, you know, doesn't have arbitrary attributes and it's got no internal structure or highly simple, because you kick the fine-tuning back again. And so that's been the kind of classical idea of God. Now a question comes up, because it's so different from what anything we find in experience, granted. Mm-hmm. This idea of a locus of this kind of personal explanation, is it, do we know it's logically coherent? We don't. And a priori grounds, we don't know it's logically, we don't know it's logically consistent either, or inconsistent either, we just don't know. I think that, you know, we don't know if the idea of a necessarily existing being is a coherent idea, and we don't know it isn't. So the fine-tuning doesn't address that question. You follow me so far?
Yeah, I'm
following you. Am I addressing what you're saying?
I kind of have in, I guess what I'm missing, though, is why, and this is obviously part of a larger conversation, but I don't see why. I object to the idea of a necessary being in any case, but right. That's another conversation entirely. I guess to go and suppose that the whole notion of personal explanation is mysterious to me. I don't know what that really means. I mean, it's supposed to be an intuitive thing where you go and you say, well, gee, I want this, and then it happens, and there's something, I will this, rather. I will X, and gosh, you know, X ends up happening. But
why are you talking to me on the phone?
Huh? Hmm? What do you mean?
Why are you talking to me on the phone?
I don't understand the... I'm missing the...
Well, you're going to give a personal explanation, right?
Okay. Yeah, sure. Well, okay, yeah, sure. Yeah, when we do indeed get personal...
So you do understand it at one level.
Yeah, on that level, yeah.
Another level, you don't. I mean, it's like I can use time, as Augustine famously said, but when you think about it, I have no clue what it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, so anything, almost anything in philosophy, if you think about it enough, you really do reach bafflement all around. So, yeah, we have an idea of a personal explanation. We use it all the time. It's just that when we think about it, we can't explicate it in terms of anything deeper often. It just kind of stops.
I guess I feel I can, because I would characterize that as just a relationship between certain conscious states and then certain results. That there's I think Hume is right about causality fundamentally, and that we probably disagree there. But I mean, I don't have any notion of cause and effect outside the context of just some structure where you have, and it can be very complicated, but in the end, you have patterns. And it's like, okay, a personal explanation in the end is going to be, and of course, this is foiled. I can will things and they can not happen, right? I can be paralyzed and I can really try to move my arm and it doesn't move. But I guess I don't see anything special about a personal explanation, except insofar as you have a phenomenal experience of a certain sort, and then it's followed by another phenomenal experience, or to get away from that kind of language, it's followed by the movement of a body or whatever it might be. And I guess that's, you might as well say, you know, that you know, that you have personal explanations, and then you have coffee cup hurling explanations or something, where, or coffee cup falling explanations, where a coffee cup falls and that can have certain effects. And, you know, I mean, it's like, I don't see what's so special, and why cut up the world of explanation into, you know, mechanical explanations, personal explanations, and you indicated that there was another sort of explanation. It seems like you're taking one kind of narrow class of explanations, and you're kind of making it, you know, you're privileging it and saying, well, this is like one of the three categories. And I guess I don't see what's so privileged about that relationship between a phenomenal experience on my part and a particular thing happening, such that I would want to go and say that this is going to explain the origin of the universe.
Well, if you took a Humean view of what personal explanation is and causation, then granted, it wouldn't get you very far. It would just put another regularity at a higher, higher level. But I think the problem there is not with the privileging or putting at a higher level personal explanation. The problem is with the Humean view, because the Humean view is going to just undercut almost everything. I mean, it leads to an ultimate skepticism. Let me ask you, why? Okay, as a Humean, why do you believe in, what gives rise to our solid belief that there's this regularity?
Oh, no, that, I think Hume was right. That's just a fact about us. There's no deeper, there's no justification for it. It's just, that's just the way things are. I have this deep in my bones belief, though I can reflect upon it and realize it's not justified. There's, I'm going to proceed as if it were true, but, you know, that's kind of the bottom line. I don't think there's anything inconsistent in that. I think it's just
a
recognition
of our position. It's because it's, you know, psychological, then you're given a causal explanation. So he's going to just have to say, that's what I believe, because anytime he tries to invoke anything more, he's going to be giving causes. And he can't give you any causes for why we hold this. He can't give any justification for continuing to believe. You can't even give a justification anywhere, because you can't go anywhere if it's completely skeptical. Why even you think the past is not just an illusion?
No, indeed, it could be. But the thing is, once I go and I say, well, look, I'm going to go and assume this. This is something I want to be a being who can act in that robust sense. So I'm going to use induction. Well, then I can go and, once I've assumed induction, I can go and talk about psychology and physiology in the past and things like that, you know. To make that initial leap, though, indeed, I think we should all recognize that we don't have a justification for it, even if we want one.
Okay,
I can't imagine.
How does your want to be practical explain why you're practical?
Mm-hmm. How does it explain why I'm practical?
In
any given moment, we have to go and look at this in terms of a moment, all right?
Right.
The kind of a phenomenal moment, all right? You know, in terms of, like, this is just, I can't break down my experience in any finer, to a finer degree than this. So in a phenomenal moment, it's like, okay, I go and I act as if this is, the coffee cup is going to fall if I let it go. That's I can go, you know, of course, another thought, I have to go and reflect upon that, and I have to say, look, maybe right now I'm thinking, gee, I'm going to go and drop this coffee cup, but induction may not be true. And yet, in that moment, I just want to proceed as if that's the case. So it's like...
But how is that connected with anything you do? Because there's no causal relations anymore. So your wants are irrelevant. Your wants could be... You could want something, and it could be followed by just the opposite.
Well, no. But it could
why you do anything.
Sure.
Every time you invoke, I want this, and this happens, or I will this, you're already invoking all this causal language.
You're
going to be a thorough Humean, get rid of it all, talk about regularities.
But here's the thing, though. It has happened so far that, or at least, you know, it seems to me like it's happened so far that when I willed things, they've happened. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, I'm just assuming that, you know, it's going to happen. It could happen. It's not as if it's impossible that the regularities won't continue to hold, right? I mean, it's like, no, in fact, it could be the case that my will in fact be effective. And so I'm just proceeding as if my
will... Well, no, your will can't be effective, because only your will doesn't do anything. There's no causal relationships. It couldn't be effective.
Well, when I say effective, what I mean is simply that, in fact, my will be followed with that particular outcome. That's all I mean by effective here. You know, in this particular case, yes, my willingness will be followed by the coffee cup falling, you know.
I mean, right, and so it all just is a matter of kind of that there's these sequences of events that occur mm-hmm. in the world, and they've occurred in the past. It's a complete regularity theory, mm-hmm. and they just happen to go on in a regular way. But they could have went in any other way. It just happens to be the world just happens to keep going on regularly, and that's all you can say. That sounds like a huge, first of all, you know, it undermines any confidence you should have in induction. You're only doing induction. Mm-hmm. You're only having a regularity. Your conscious has a regularity that you call it. Believing in induction, let's call that the regularity of your conscious moments, believing in induction regularity. Mm-hmm. You just have that, but there's no reason for it. You just have it, and you could have had it differently. Just your regularity and somebody else's regularity is to have something different. Somebody else's regularity is to believe in God, something rather other people's regularity is this. So in the end of the day, no one has justification for anything, so why bother?
Well, here's the thing, though. If because others do, in fact, assume induction, though, once you go and you have induction, induction is special. It's different from other assumptions that we make. Insofar as, you know, we can't, it's not as if you can criticize somebody morally or even pragmatically until you have a theory like induction, some kind of meta theory. Now, there are other meta theories, too, that we could go and, a meta strategy, I should say. There are other meta strategies apart from induction. But in fact, like I say, that there are things that are attractive about induction to me, and that's the one I'm going to use. But I can't, assuming that, from within induction, I can criticize all kinds of things. So, of course, my criticism of the theist will be under the umbrella of induction. However, it turns out that the theist is going to go and be under that umbrella, too. I mean, it's not as if I'm speaking to people who aren't also proceeding as if that were true. The only difference is that I'm not pretending that I have some further justification of induction. You know, I mean, it's justifications occur generally, except for the analytic things, occur underneath that umbrella. So, no, I will go and criticize the theist. And if he goes and he says, you don't have any reason to go and assume induction, I'll say, Well, sure, it's true. Neither do you, but we're both going to use it. And furthermore, you can't criticize me without some kind of meta strategy. You can't call me unethical or unethical outside of some meta strategy. As it turns out, given our common meta strategy of induction, under that, I can criticize you. You know, because in fact, there are certain consequences we can expect your actions to have.
Well, affected under induction, if we both assume induction, but they could criticize you because you'd have to have a further basis. Why couldn't they just say, well, they just say, you know, you shouldn't be doing this. What you'd have to assume some deeper justification, otherwise you just beg the question. But the paper I sent both of you, I actually do talk about that issue of induction there, because I think what the theist is committed to is it turns out to that our normal inductive practices are normally turn out to be the same, but the theist is committed to, because they believe God is perfectly good, their ultimate commitment is really a form of what's called axiarchism, that the world is structured to realize goodness, okay, value. And as it turns out, you can argue from there if there's a certain value of the world being regular for embodied conscious agents, certain values realized by that, then you would expect a regular world. So deductive practice would be justified by this ultimate assumption the world is structured for the good, where the other one has it just structured for, you know, in terms of regularity. We're on a kind of ground zero here. One is structured towards the good, the other is structured towards regularity. And then I argue the other one, the structure towards the good, is actually a superior assumption, explains more. Then that piece, I move from there to, I say, well, then that's the core one. Then, you know, you can argue from there, perhaps, to theism or some other grounding for it. Mm. But you're getting into very deep issues here. The problem is, the Humean skepticism is a double-edged sword. If you try to use it on the theist, it'll cut you down, because it casts skepticism across the board.
I think skepticism can be, in a sense, yes, there is skepticism, but you can bracket the skepticism, I think. And so I don't think it's a problem. And
I think can bracket it arbitrarily. I would agree with that. But then people can, you know, if you're going to go arbitrary, everybody can do that.
Well, anyway, I suppose we are, you know, going a bit far afield. Induction, actually.
Yeah, we're getting a far afield, and we're already at one.
I'll tell you
we're
what.
An hour and a half into it.
it's funny that, you know, I swear 50% of our podcasts are in part, at least, about induction. It comes up all the time here. But it's great. It's always fun to talk about, as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, I don't know. Would you have anything else, Ben? Or Dr. Collins?
Obviously there are, when I reread this over the last couple of days, and there are a number of moves that you want to make, Professor Collins, that I don't want to follow you making those moves. I don't agree at all. But unfortunately we can't talk about all of them. We talked briefly about what I would consider is the most serious concern, which is I don't see any reason to go and apply the principle of indifference, and moreover, when we do apply the principle of indifference, I don't see how we can consistently apply it. So I don't know, but you did respond to that. I guess I just don't understand your response. But
yeah, there's a more detailed detailed argument is in the reader, which I couldn't possibly go through.
I guess I can look at that again. Maybe I'll, I don't know, maybe on my blog or something, I'll write about it. And in any case, though, it's been really great having you on the show. I appreciate you making the time to come on.
Yes, thank you very much.
Off the air, I want to know what your other two objections are.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's fine.
So whenever you're off the air, because we're not going to be discussing them, because we don't want to go another hour. So.
Yes. All right. Well, let's go ahead and close. And Professor Collins, did you want to give any closing remarks before I do the announcements?
I think it's just, you know, go look at. I'll put more of the writings up on the web, but go look at what I've said in my writings, because I've worked out, you know, these in the arguments in quite a bit of detail, and I don't obviously see the problem the two co-hosts here see as near as big as they do. I would see the multiverse as the more major objection myself. So
okay.
I don't really have a lot more to say about it than that.
Sure.
Just look at the stuff.
All right, then. Well, the links will be on the blog. So if you go to goodnessovergod.blogspot.com, presumably you've already been there to download and listen to this podcast. We'll have on the blog, goodnessovergod.blogspot.com, we will make available links to Professor Collins' webpage, his webpage on the fine-tuning argument, as well as a link to the infidels.org article where he debates an atheist, right? So we'll make
right,
that available.
And you also might just, in general, make a link for these kind of questions to Closer to Truth. That's a website Robert Kuhn has put on. He's interviewed lots of people on both sides of various issues. And that's a really good one to go to for short interviews.
Okay, well, that'll
general,
be in the...
another link you should have on there. And he interviewed me, but he's interviewed like 100 people or more.
All right, well, make sure that's on the blog, too, then, as well. Also, if you do want to be a guest in the podcast, feel free to drop us a line. Our email is goodnessovergod@gmail.com. So if you're listening, you have some questions, you disagree with us, I don't know, maybe you think we've just lost our minds and you want to set us straight, go ahead and drop us a line at that email address, goodnessovergod@gmail.com. So again, Professor Collins, it's been wonderful having you on the show today, and we will see you all next time.